Welcome back, everyone, to Frenemies, the podcast where sales and marketing talk. My name is Julia Hartwig, and I'm the head of marketing at Precenter. And today I'm joined by Martin Majussen, who is a partner at Quadrant Consultant and the author of the book Teams That Sell, which we will talk about today. Hi, Martin.
Hey, Julia.
Yes, so I have the book here, Teams That Sell, and in the title, you're stating or you're saying, you know, how to set, build and manage high performing teams in the new era of B2B sales. So what shift did you notice in B2B sales that companies seem to struggle with at the moment?
Maybe some of the same shifts that you're experiencing in your own company, which is we're just dependent on collaboration with other people in order to sell these days. If you think back 10 years ago, 20 years ago, it was a little bit simpler. It's not like it was easy to sell, but it was a little bit simpler. You had some marketing managers that did some demand generation in the market and some salespeople that capitalized on that to sell. And there was a pretty limited need for collaboration between those two. Now the buyers have changed. They're sort of using interchangeably digital touch points, virtual, face-to-face throughout the entire buying process. And also, we just have a lot more specialists working in the commercial organization. So if you just think about your own marketing department, you probably have someone who's really good at digital marketing and performance marketing. You probably have someone who's really good at content creation, copywriting, maybe someone who's good in creative stuff, someone who's good at doing the stuff that you are doing here. So we just have many more specialists as well. And the same goes in the sales organization. So more specialists, more dependency on collaboration between sales, marketing, within sales. And that's really driving the need for us to become better at working as a team around selling.
Yes, and I think for me, I mean, that's one thing I keep on pointing out as a key difference between sales and marketing, because as you say, marketing essentially, I think we are very well aware that everything is a team effort, because most of the times you are very specialized. So as you say, you have a content creator, you have a performance marketing manager, you have product marketing, and, you know, to create great marketing strategies, you need to bring all of these disciplines together. Whereas in sales, a lot of times you don't have this specialism. So I have made the experience lots of times that there is still very much the lone wolf mentality around in sales. And that speciality rather like goes as hierarchy. So the natural progression of a sales career, right? Starting as like SDR, BDR, and then progressing to account executive and following that, but not that much specialism when it comes to the area of work other than maybe, you know, localized setups in regional teams. And I think that's something that I really like in the book, that you argue a lot of going away from the lone wolf mentality in sales towards a team mentality. Why do you emphasize this specific point on the team mentality in sales that needs to change and that sales leaders, of course, need to create?
Well, let's think about how salespeople have been talked to for the past 100 years. Everything has been around, you know, you as an individual, your individual targets. How do you become a star performer? Everything has been centered around a divide and conquer approach, where we just carve up a territory into smaller pieces, give it to one salesperson, and then we try to optimize everything at that individual level. It's sales training done towards the individual. How do you become better at these things? The way we give territories, the way we incentivize. So basically, since the invention of selling, everything we've told salespeople has been around that selling is an individual discipline. But at the same time, we can see from data, and I think I have some of that research in the book, that those sales organizations where they don't see it as an individual discipline and don't work with it as an individual discipline, where they actually bring in more different people into the selling process, make it a team effort, they just do better. And the same goes for salespeople that are able to actually work with selling as a team discipline, where they bring in more people into the opportunities, they do better. So all we're arguing in the book is basically that it might be a good idea to take this more serious and then hardwire it into the way you're organized and how you work with selling. So it's not just something that is left to chance and that there's some salespeople that have seen the lights and start working with selling as a team discipline, but that you actually hardwire that into your organization.
One aspect of that I think could be difficult for organizations to change towards is that moving towards that, of course, as you say, also means you have to build up quotas differently, because then you can't have individual quotas, you can't have individual bonuses, because, you know, then it all falls with that, because that's a big reason of why sellers are lone wolves, right? Because they fight for their own to reach their own targets and so on. So it seems like, you know, that is, of course, a change that is quite big. So how would you recommend that companies actually get started to move towards that direction?
I think one important thing is not to look at it as either or, that just because we want more incentives to work as a team doesn't mean we don't want individual incentives either. So let's say you and I were working on the same sales team. You were the technical specialist, I was the lead, so the account executive. Then we both should probably be measured on the things that we need to bring to the table. And some of our compensation should probably be tied to how well we do that. But you probably want to shift some of the incentives away from being only at the individual level to a more balanced way of looking at it, where there's more focus on how the team does as a whole. Some companies are only going over to saying how the sales organization do as a whole, because we're more dependent on collaboration. We do the same thing in here. We're a consultancy. We have bonuses for people. But actually, we've decided to say almost 100% of the bonuses that we give out are team-based. Then there's an individual component to it as well. But it's just out of a recognition that we're so dependent on each other that having everyone optimize at an individual level doesn't really make sense. And I also have worked with salespeople now for the past 12 years, and I really think, contrary to popular belief, that salespeople are not these people that just look at what is my bonus the next quarter, how much money can I get. I think that's a really unnuanced way of looking at the salespeople that we work with anyway. Obviously, incentives matter, but they also like to be part of something. They like to be on a team where they have a greater mission. They like to go to work and be engaged in the stuff that they do. And I think they are less so if they just work alone, and more so if they work on a team. And I think there was a study done on it as well, where people who work alone are, you know, only 8% of those are engaged in their work. But if they're on a team with a manager that they trust, then it goes up by 5x or something like that. So I don't think salespeople only look at how much money am I paid out at the end of the month. I think there's a lot of other factors that goes into motivating them to show up, engage at their work.
Yeah, and I think what you're describing is a bit like the chicken and egg problem, right? Because of course, if companies focus everything for sellers on individual bonuses and on individual payouts, then of course that becomes the thing that motivates them. But changing that and actually, as you say, giving them the feeling of my work has purpose and I'm part of something bigger and I know what I'm doing this for, other than just monetary benefits, of course motivates them differently. But I think, you know, always the bonus payout question is a really interesting one also in terms of like marketing and sales. Because of course, like, you know, the better marketing does, the easier sales has it, right? And I'm not saying that marketing should get a bonus as well, but I just always find that a very interesting point in this collaboration, because of course it goes very much hand in hand. And if you have a very skilled marketing team and a good strategy, and you're actually like both creating and capturing demand, then the sales team has an easier time as well, right?
Yeah, then I'll say it for you, Julia. I absolutely think that the marketing should get a part of the bonus as well. We see these cases quite a lot where you have salespeople that are closing a lot of sales. So on paper, it looks like, wow, they're really out there selling, and they get paid commission on the sales that they do. But then when you then do the analysis on the opportunities that they closed, you see that maybe 80% came in through the website, and it was basically purchasing requests. So they're basically saying, I want to buy something. And a salesperson is then just accommodating that purchasing request. And in my world, that's, you know, we can have a salesperson take care of it, but I probably wouldn't then compensate them as if they had created that sale from scratch in the same way. So I absolutely think that marketing should be in on the bonus program too, and yeah, be incentivized as well to do their work. But having said that, you know, it's also a little bit of a misconception, I think, that just because salespeople get less in individual bonus because more is transferred over at the team level, it doesn't mean that they get less overall. Actually, the logic is that if we are able to work together, we will perform better as a team, and everyone benefits from that. So it's just important to say that it's not that we are necessarily putting down the bonus of salespeople. It's just less of it is tied to individual effort.
Yes, and I mean that, you know, makes a lot of sense. Another thing I'm wondering about, looking at the personality traits that sellers most typically have. I mean, they are normally very very confident, very outgoing people, but also very competitive people, right? How does that work? Because for me, I mean, when building a team, you normally want to have complementary personality types, right? How does that work in the sales team, where you a lot of times see a lot of very similar personality types that are driven by competition?
The problem only comes if they're driven by competition against each other. Mm. So you could imagine a sales team where everyone is competing against each other on that team. It's much, much better to compete against the market, to compete against competitors, and then be on the same team together instead. So I don't see anything wrong with being competitive. On the contrary, I'm incredibly competitive myself, but not against my colleagues, right? I'm competitive against the market, everything else. I want to win, but I'm in the same boat as my colleagues, and we work together around that. So I think it's just shifting the perspective a little bit, that competitive doesn't necessarily mean that you're also an individualist. You can be competitive but still be part of a team. We know that from sports, right? That if you have a football player that's just an individual, only looks after himself, that person will not do very well on a sports team, because obviously you're dependent on all the other players. I think it was Simon Sinek who did this TED talk where he's explaining about some army team or SWAT team or something like that, Navy SEAL, I think it was, where he's drawing up a conversation that he had with the leaders of one of those teams, where he asked, like, who do you want? Do you want the best, who's an individual, or someone who's good but can also be good part of a team? And it's always, we want that person who understands how we succeed as a team rather than succeeding individually. And it's the same thing in sales, I think.
But do you find that that's a trait? Because again, I mean, there is a shift that needs to happen to get organizations there, right, where they think of it as a team thing. So of course, it also needs a very different approach in sales leadership. But also, again, of course, like building that trust within organizations of, okay, we're moving away from it's everything on you and all of you against each other, towards we're working here together. We're like in the same boat, pushing this entire boat towards land. So how can sales managers, sales leaders actually build up this experience to mark this shift?
Yeah, so there's a few different things that you need to get in place and in a set order. One of the things that you need to get in place first, or maybe the thing, is everyone is aligned around a description of why are we here? What is it that we're supposed to collaborate around? how do we see the world we're supposed to collaborate in? So getting on the same page and making sure everyone views what they're supposed to succeed with as a team, that's number one. And it's because very often, then a team will go on a two-day offsite and just focus on building relationship trust first. But then everyone comes home and is like, what were we supposed to do again? So having that clarity on what is it that we're supposed to do? How do each of us contribute into this thing that we're supposed to work on becomes incredibly important. And it's the team leader's responsibility to not co-create it, but to come with his or her perspective on it, and then align the team around it. So getting on the same page, that's number one. Then what we have afterwards, and research is pretty clear on what makes teams perform. And at the heart of it is whether people trust each other. But there's a common misconception that is always, relational trust. So the kind of trust where, I trust you to mean well for me. I trust you to have my best interest in yours. So that kind of trust. But there's an even more fundamental trust when you're supposed to be on the same team, which is, do I trust you to do your job? Because now my compensation and success is tied to yours. So do I trust you? If we're on the same team and you're a marketing manager that's supposed to deliver content that I use in sales situation that customers consume online, do I trust you to do your job well? Because if I don't, it doesn't really matter if I like you as a person. If I don't trust that you're going to be able to contribute, then it falls apart. So that's the number one thing I would focus on building first after you've gotten on the same page. And there's only one way to do that, which is to start working together and getting in the trenches. So this thing that this idea that you can build trust on a two-day offsite somewhere, I don't buy into that. I think you have to start working together before you can develop the trust in that you will be able to do your job well. And then afterwards, of course, we have to keep working on making sure that people have the kind of relational trust in each other that's required to succeed.
And I think for me, like work-wise, when you say that with trust, a key part of collaborating is also, accountability. The more you collaborate, actually also seeing, okay, these are your strengths, these are my strengths, and actually they combine very well. So for this, I'm actually going to come to you because I know you have more experience in that. And I don't know, you're more creative in that. But I'm very good at analysis and data. So I'm going to come with that part and actually, seeing how that becomes very, very fruitful, which I think is something that builds a lot of trust. But again, of course, it needs both sides. It needs the atmosphere and the collaboration to give the trust as well, to actually allow for, yes, this is something I can improve on.
I think that is the really hard part for a sales manager. Traditional sales manager shifting into the role of a team leader. You could imagine that you've been a sales manager for 10 years and your organization has been one of just salespeople. So you've had 6 to 8 salespeople working on their own individual things. That just means that your management style is going to be centered around one-to-one interactions predominantly. You might have, weekly team check-ins, monthly team meetings, but predominantly it's one-to-one management. I observe you selling, give you feedback on that. I do individual skills coaching. I coach you on the opportunities you're working on. So it's one-to-one. Now, if I'm shifting over to a team that sell, then I still have some of those one-to-one interactions, but suddenly I have to manage the team dynamics as well. And that's a bit of a tricky shift for many sales managers who's been used to just managing individuals, suddenly having to manage individuals, but also managing team dynamics, because that's a more advanced discipline. You're used to it in marketing because you've been working together as a team with different specialists for years. But in sales, it's different. There, the sales management operating model is much more centered around one-to-one interactions rather than team dynamics.
Hmm. I understand. One other thing you point out in the book, which I'm obviously a very big fan of, is actually that, again, in terms of collaboration company-wide, companies should shift from kind of this assembly line structure that still exists in a lot of companies and is a big reason for why I'm having this podcast of marketing does this part, lead comes in, okay, bam, it's over to sales. So what is it kind of that you would suggest how companies can start moving away from that and actually seeing more collaboration between sales and marketing?
Well, so let's just think about the assembly line for a little bit. I think I have the story in the book about the automotive industry as well, which is really famous for their version of the assembly line, which is basically you take a process, you divide it into a lot of smaller parts, and then you have some specialists just taking care of each of those parts. But basically, you know, the product is just passing through, and that's that way of setting up work to process something works really, really well if you have low variability. So it's more, it's the same thing every single time. Low complexity, so it's easy for me to carve it into smaller pieces, and also that it's moving forward all the time. So when something comes in, it just moves in one direction. That used to be incredibly popular in the automotive industry back when you had less complex cars. Maybe all the parts were manufactured close to the production facility and you could get the car in only black, something like that. So you could carve a car production process into 84 steps and have people take care of it. Nowadays, making a car is incredibly complex. You can get it in so many different versions. You can get it in, you know, parts are coming from all over the world. So actually, car manufacturers are moving into working much more as a team as well, rather than having this assembly line set up. Now, in software as a service sales, adopting a assembly line setup has been the predominant way of driving growth. We have someone out here who's generating demand, someone who's capturing leads, someone who's converting those leads and qualifying them, someone who takes that initial call, someone who tries to close it, someone who then works with customer success afterwards. And in software as a service, it's worked quite well because you needed to scale quickly. So you try to build the most simple setup that you can so you can scale that. And it's also worked well in the way that most software as a service companies have a quite narrow product offering to a narrow set of target buyers. So there it's a repeatable process that you can just run again and again and again. Now, the trick to making it work is then making sure that you actually have connection and alignment between the different parts that you build into the value chain. And that's what a lot of software as a service companies have been struggling with, or any company who built up this assembly line approach to selling. The problem is that you, even though you try to set up, you know, strong KPIs, weekly meeting, we still see that there's always problems when marketing generate leads and sales, they don't like them or they don't pick up the leads. And that continues to be a problem, even though for years we've said this is important to solve. It hasn't been solved there yet. So there's something that isn't working with that large scale factory of an assembly line. So I think a much better approach to taking to it is say, well, what if we build mini factories? You know, the buying process is still what the buying process is, but what if, you know, you had one of your people from marketing join an operating unit or a pod with someone from inside sales, someone from customer success, and they work much closer together as a team. Then you have a lot of the friction that exists that is healthy along a factory line like that. You would just get it at a much smaller scale, and the feedback loops would be much quicker. So I think that would work a lot better than trying to set up this mega factory where we are pushing customers through. And then in a lot of the companies that we work with, it's just too complex to set up selling as a factory line. The product portfolios are too complex. the kind of customers they have are too complex. And we also know that buyers, they don't move forward in a linear process when they're buying. It's a messy buying process. They move back and forth. They, you know, they go and check products and then they move back to, do we even have a problem? So they go back and forth. So this idea that the assembly line is moving forward all the time, in reality, it doesn't really exist. So it doesn't make sense to talk about, now I'm handing it over, because then you would also have to say, oh, then we have to take it back again. So I think this large-scale mega factory assembly line approach to selling is just outdated for most companies.
Yeah, what you just said with the buyers journey is something I wanted to point out as well, because of course when like the good old funnel idea came up 100 years ago, I mean, you know, we of course love simple visualizations like that, but it's unfortunately not how it works anymore. I mean, you know, right. it's a constant move, and the buyer's journey is basically just a crazy line going from one point to the next, also because buying committees have become so big, so it's not just this one buyer you're looking at. I mean, this year it's I think the average buying committee is 10 people or 9.8. So I mean that's a lot of buyers, and that of course also just grows dependent on the size of the buying company. So there's so many factors involved in that, but also what you said in like the collaboration and kind of these ties in between. I mean, that's something we're working very very much on at Precentor. And exactly as you said, not only sales and marketing, but actually also having product in there to have customer success in there, which I really over and over again really see us all benefiting from, because customer success actually know what's coming. They are involved, and also they know, of course, our customers really well. So they can suggest to our sellers, oh, listen, we have this one customer. They had a similar like struggle. Yes. You know, should we connect them? Should we like make a case? What can we do? And I'm there and I can say, sure, I'm happy to interview them, and let's get out a customer case, and things like that, which really really helps. And I think that's one of the things we talked about before as well, but I call them deal labs, but actually grouping together one person from each team to solve specific problems, which can of course be sales related problems, like there is a big deal in the pipeline that you want to close, and everybody brainstorming on, okay, what can we do there? Is there, you know, do we have a new product update that we can promote to them, or, you know, just buzzing around these ideas, which also really, really strengthen this collaboration. But also, as you say, kind of the specialist angle of everybody comes with their own experience and skills and knowledge, and bringing that together creates more innovation and also creativity, but at the same time also motivation, because everybody can see, hey, I'm actually part of this. I'm not in sales, I'm not closing the deal, but I'm part of what happens here, and we all take part of the success.
And if we you know, the book is written for commercial executives around how they should organize their commercial organization. But if we just take that aside, the organization question, the easiest way to get started on this is probably just, you know, next time you have a sales opportunity, instead of the salesperson trying to do everything and take every single interaction with all the different personas that exist on the buying committee on the other side, then they start taking resources in their own organization and bringing those into play and those opportunities. So, you know, when they have to do a technical demonstration of the product, don't do the technical demonstration yourself. Get your expert in to do the technical demonstration. They have much greater credibility. They're much more able to answer questions. So whenever it comes to demonstrating the technical feasibility, bring in a technical person. When you get towards the end of the buying process, bring in customer success so they can see, well, who will I be working with once if I choose to buy this product here. They're much better at explaining that than the salesperson is. So I think it's also just a matter of, even if we don't organize around teams that sell, but just stick with having teams of sellers, then just starting to involve more people into the sales process. So you're connecting experts on the customer side with experts on your side, just works a lot better. And that goes all the way up to let's say that presenter was selling to a large company, you know, you bring your CEO into that sales process to connect with their CEO, because they would have a much greater chance of succeeding with, you know, speaking to a CEO. So just bringing in the different specialists that you have to meet the customer organization, that's just a great place to start.
Yeah, I think as always in leadership, leading by example is always the best way to make progress. So as you say, also by leadership, actually showing we're collaborating and I'm involving other people of the in the organization exactly for that purpose. Of course, also shows everybody else in the company that this is the way forward and that is how things work and what you want to strive for.
Yeah, I mean even in huge companies like Maersk, that's what they're doing, right? I mean, you have the CEO actually playing an active role in selling. Of course, it's not down to, you know, how should we configure this solution? But the CEO of Maersk will meet with the CEO of Adidas to talk about how do we support your strategy and support your business. So there you also put the entire organization in play towards the customers that they're working with and really do selling as a team effort. So maybe that's just the easiest place to start, is just by starting to involve more people into the selling activities as you see that they could be needed.
Yes, we already like talked a little bit about this, but the most important question is, of course, so what makes a team high performing?
There's luckily really good research on that. Google, I think it must be about 10 years ago now, they did this project called Project Aristotle. And if you remember your high school math, Aristotle had that thing, the sum is greater than the individual parts, right? So they called it that because they wanted to figure out what actually drives team performance. And the way they started the study was just to look at the people who were on the team, so the individuals. Is it because they have more capable people? Is it because they have more motivated people, more senior people? So they looked at the characteristics of the individual members of the team, but they couldn't find any causes of team performance. So there was no correlation between who was on the team and how that team performed. So they went back to the drawing table and tried to come up with a different perspective. And what they looked at was, we wonder if team dynamics have something to do with it. And that's where they found out that actually what characterizes high-performing teams is are these five factors of, you know, trust, do I feel that we are on a higher mission, do I feel a sense of purpose in what we're doing, is there clarity on what my responsibility is and what your responsibility is and what we're supposed to do together. So they came up with these five factors that had much more to do with team dynamics rather than who was on that team, which is why we write in the book that it matters less who you have on the team. Obviously, they need to have the right professional capabilities. If you're setting a team where you require a customer success manager, a marketing manager, and an account executive, they need to have those skills. But it doesn't matter that much how good they are. What matters more is how good you as a team leader makes that team by getting them to collaborate.
Okay, so any word of advice of of how to shift B2B sales and B2B marketing?
That's the same advice I always give, especially large companies that we work with, which is whenever you can, start small, as small as you can, so that you can learn and demonstrate that it actually works. And that's the good thing about teams that sell, is that you don't have to start out with a large scale global transformation from day one. You can actually just take a little market, maybe a subsegment there, and just ask yourself, what happens if we stop working as individuals in silos and try to maybe set it up as an assembly line approach? What happens if we instead get people on the same team, get them on the same page, and then start working with how we get them to perform as a team? Because it's much easier to convince the rest of the organization that this might be a good path to go down once they've seen it in their own business first. And it also allows you to do a lot of learnings around, well, how do we actually succeed with this that you can then scale out afterwards? So I think my advice is just to de-risk as much as you can and start as small as you can, and then scale it out from there.
I think, I love that because, of course, that is also something that is easier to get approved by leadership. Should leadership be doubtful of if this is the right way forward? Because, of course, people don't like change, and thinking of changing the entire structure of a sales team is a lot of change. Of course, leadership would first think like that requires resources and that's a lot of time wasted. So starting small is definitely a more feasible way to test. I will say though that in B2B marketing, especially in the past years, going from lead generation to demand generation, it's unfortunately an area where starting small doesn't quite work because it's a very different way to think of B2B marketing. I still have over the past years tried to kind of mix the approaches. So it's going more clearly towards demand generation versus just lead generation, but trickling in a little bit of lead generation just to still bring in a bit of MQLs and kind of fill that purpose.
that sounds really good. Maybe a last part is, I think we have to be extremely careful not to underestimate how important it is to get the sales managers or those who will become the team leaders on board the journey towards teams that sell. And it's for two reasons. They're so important in making the team work. And that's what the research showed, that it's less about who you have on the team, but how good that team is made. And that's the team leader that has that responsibility. But also they're the ones who we know from research is most likely to resist change, because they're the ones who are always hit the hardest whenever we have these change initiatives, because not only do they have to change themselves, they also have to help other people change in the organization. So we just know that change hits the frontline managers especially hard in organizations. So making sure that they are helped, enabled, trained to actually act as a team leader for this new kind of sales team or teams that sell will become really important. So not to underestimate that.
Yeah, I think that's an incredibly good point, because I feel like no matter what department, it's something I've seen of a lot of times actually leadership training missing. Like taking people to that level to get to a manager position and be a team lead and be a supporter, enabler, and mentor in that way rather than just an individual, I think overall is something that that companies need to work on more and actually think into the natural progression of their employees rather than just letting everybody figure it out on their own, because of course there are very different management styles, but as you say, it's important to have this focus and also have the right tools to actually understand how to motivate team members.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for joining today, Martin. Well, yeah, thanks again for joining and giving your insights on teams that sell, and to everybody out there. Of course, feel free to write or comment if you have questions. I'm happy to forward them to Martin and then get started on creating a high-performing team that sells.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me, Julia.